convenient, use our website, kpft.org. And while you're there, listen in. And thank you.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
It is 5 p.m. Thursday, and it's time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer and tonight's host, and every week, along with a great crew, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls. You know, ideally, a good father loves his children, but he doesn't let them get away with everything. He might disapprove of a kid's misdeeds, using tough love to prove a point, but he does so through the power of his words. A good father realizes that his children are human and that making mistakes is part of growing up. All good-sounding ideas. And other traits might include protecting his family at all costs, always being supportive, spending quality time, and knowing what quality time is, leading by example, and of course, unconditional love. But I'd like to add another. A good dad is always around, even if he's not around. That may sound a little strange, but I think you get the idea in just a few minutes. So tonight, we celebrate Dad, and I hope the stories that you hear remind us about the depth of a father's heart and the children who love them. You know, some of my favorite storytellers aren't famous, but my favorite celebrity teller is Billy Crystal. In his book, 700 Sundays, he chronicles times with his father, going to Yankee Stadium, a place Billy, his father, his brother, always thought of as the promised land. Clean, green, freshly cut grass, framing a mosaic filled with colorful uniforms, men throwing baseballs, families smiling, patiently waiting in concession lines, young boys with caps on and gloves in their hand, beating it with their fists in preparation for a foul ball. He reflects on a particular Sunday in the schoolyard with his father. Billy's 10 years old. His dad is pitching to him. Now, he's pretty good, Crystal contends, because he's played some ball in school. And I'm going for the fence, Billy says, because I want to hit those home runs. And his father says, Billy, you're not a power hitter. You're better. You know how to get on base. Just meet the ball, Billy. Just meet the ball. Well, in the story, Billy imitates his father's pitch softly, rhythmically, and then demonstrates his easy swing, popping it in a right field and then again, a blooper in a right, hitting it into the opposite field, meeting the ball. I didn't miss a pitch, Billy says. Didn't miss a pitch. And my dad says, Man, you are the best, Billy. No, Dad, you are. The tenderness conveyed by Billy is fueled by nothing short of raw honesty, a speck in time so seemingly incidental to most and so essential to the teller, the kind of authenticity that can only accompany a love story. A story entitled My Father is a Liar is a statement, despite what the title might suggest, about the integrity which envelops a father's protection and unconditional love. It's a story about an immigrant father telling the story from the perspective of his little girl. Enjoy.
Daddy is the sweetest daddy in the world. Daddy is the most handsome. The smartest. The most clever. The kindest. My Superman. Daddy wants me to do well at school. Daddy is just great, but he lies. About having a job. He lies about having money. He lies that he's not tired. He lies that he's not hungry. He lies that we have everything. He lies about his happiness. He lies because of me.
You know, it's hard to imagine a story like that. I know that it's a visual story, but you love storytelling. That's why you tune in every week. So try to imagine the image in your mind, a father with anguish on his face and tears rolling down his cheeks, often demonstrating those emotions while in a private space. It ends when he is hugging his little girl. His little girl, my daddy lies because he loves me. Kind of reminds me of the 1997 film Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni. It's a father and son imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. And the father, of course, uses his fertile imagination in order to keep his son safe and unafraid. Dear friend and co-host of this show, Eric Heen, is a storyteller with a range most can only envy. Telling stories that make us laugh is his stock in trade, but this story, I think one of his best, molds his humor into a serious story, yet it's a story laced with humor because Eric does what Mark Twain claims good storytellers can do. They can show us something that they know what's funny, but do it in a way so that we also know it isn't. Here's Eric. Enjoy.
I fell in love with a woman. She just divorced an abusive man, and there was rumors that she had issues with alcohol. So this was not a good recipe for a healthy relationship, but I was in love. I moved in with her. To complicate things, she had two daughters, 12 and 14 years old. The first thing the youngest daughter, Bridget, said to me the day I moved in was, "My real dad is going to kick your ass." I shrugged that off. The mother much to do with them kids. But almost right away, these paternal instincts just kind of kicked in. And I'd get so I would want to help them with their homework, or if boys came around, I'd get really protective. I was feeling kind of fatherly there. The older girl, she was very independent, no problems at all with her. But this younger girl, Bridget, she terrorized me. She'd call me names, she'd come to me. And she'd come up behind me and hit me in the back as hard as she could and then run off. But I always figured that maybe it's just an act, and then maybe deep down she had a good heart. Well, as time went on, the mother relapsed into some alcohol issues, so this interfered with her parental skills. Was a deadbeat as well. So I looked at this Bridget, and I'm thinking, you know, kids. And so I'd do stuff. I bought her a guitar lessons. I'd go to her school programs and clap for her, trying to do what I could. But all through, treated me just like crap. But I thought, well, it's not that bad because at least she's on the right track, you know. But in the long run, maybe I wasn't doing so good there, because after a while, she started skipping classes. She got busted for shoplifting. Eventually, she was starting to use drugs. It didn't look good for Bridget. One day, the older sister at work, and she said, "Bridget's been arrested, and Mom is not in any condition to handle the situation." So I rushed over to the police station, and juvenile officer told me that Bridget had gotten into a fight with another girl and that Bridget had pulled out a knife. They brought me back to this room back there where she was sitting, and as soon as she saw me, she said, "Get him out of here. He's not my real dad." So they brought me back out to the front. They said, "Yeah, technically, you're not the legal guardian, so get out." Well, I went home, and I looked around, and I thought, what the hell am I here? So I didn't love the mother for a long time. Bridget hated my guts, and I wasn't her father. Right then, I decided, people don't change. And if you try to help them change, you're only gonna waste your own life. Within 24 hours, I was packed up and I was gone. And I cut off all communications with them. There's a little more to the story. 10 years later, I'm living here, got a whole new life. About the time Facebook came out, I joined, and right off the bat, I get this message, and it's from Bridget. She said that she'd been trying to find me for years, and that she said, "Call me right away, it's very important," and she had her phone number there. And I looked at her Facebook page. Here, she's a realtor. She's volunteers for all these community projects. She changed. I was wrong. So I called the number and hear her voice, all these memories flooding back. She said that all through her childhood, that I was the only one effort. And she said when she changed that I was her role model for that. And she said, I met this really great guy. She said, he reminds me of you. And she said, I want you to come give me away at my wedding ceremony next month. And I said, hell yeah, I'll do it. And I said, but why aren't you asking your real dad? And she said, I am.
It's a stepdaughter's tale, a journey, really, in defining a father. You know, I tell lots of stories about family, about my own family, but the most difficult ones are about my biological father. But I thank him for teaching me, albeit unintentionally, about how to be, or at least try to be, a good father. Stories like these are sometimes difficult for me to tell, and this one I was compelled to deliver at a moth a few years back.
You know, to me, a father isn't someone who necessarily stands tall. It's someone who can bend down the face of a child. But my dad left me when I was 14 years old. He wasn't a bad man, but he was sick and he was weak. And it's one of the reasons why my favorite plays is I Never Sang for My Father by Robert Anderson. It's a play, of course, that many of you know, and singing is seen very literal by the main character, but it's also a motif about the fact that there are certain things that fathers and sons should do together. And I never really had that experience. But I wanted to be a great father, that wife, and I wanted to be one. You looked in the dictionary, you saw the word father, you saw my photos, you know. That's what I wanted. So you can imagine how I felt when I came home 2 days before my birthday in 1989, and I found that my family wasn't there. My two-year-old son and my ex-wife, his mother, were gone. I knew that she hated it here, and I've talked about this before, and it was all orchestrated by her multi-million-dollar father and a number of other things, and my heart was ripped to shreds. I saw his things scattered about, his toys, his clothes. I didn't quite know what to do. But I did know that talking to lawyers was the wrong idea, because as soon as I talked to them, they talked about everything that was legal and nothing that was right. They didn't talk about how I needed to cultivate a relationship with my son. But I have to tell you, there was a time where I muttered to myself, does this run in the family? Because I was really scared. It made me feel awful. So I wrote journals, and I called my son every day for years, including his teachers. And I wrote journals, and I wrote notes every week, and more extensive letters every month. And I went to Florida, that's where they were, every month for 17 years. You heard that right, 17 years. Every month for 17 years, I have my receipts from all of my airfare to prove it, but more importantly, as a way to remember that a real father, one who tests his strength, who knows what love is when they have to test that perseverance. There were a lot of great memorable weekends, I remember, and when my parents moved to Florida, it was easier for me to navigate my way around and to feel more comfortable. But Father's Day, 1999, my son was 12 years old, and I had been going for all of these years. And when I got there on the weekend, he had a friend who wanted to spend the weekend, and that was fine, and we went to a movie. And my son and his friend are walking in front of me. You know, they don't want any part of anybody over the age of 19, right? And I was a little bit older than them. And they're walking in front of me, And I hear them having a conversation, and my son's friend turns to him and says, you know, my dad's never around. And my son says to him, oh, my dad's always here. Yeah. Always here. I live 997 miles away, and he thought I was always here. I always helped him with his homework every time I arrived, and I asked him what his homework assignment was, and he had some trepidation in telling me. He was kind of reticent. I said, well, tell me what your homework is, Josh. I help you every month. He said, I don't want to talk about it. He was embarrassed. Well, after some probing and prodding, he told me that his homework assignment was to write about the favorite thing in his room. So, well, that's a pretty cool assignment. Let's talk about that. What is it? I almost begged him. And he said, okay, my favorite thing in my room, send me every week. And I thought about that. 4 years ago, I got a call that my father died. And my brother and I had to take care of all the arrangements. Now, the worst thing about that call, the person who called said, I'm sorry for your loss. I didn't know what to say. I wanted to say something. God, I wanted to feel something. But I didn't. I never sang for my father. I never sang for him. But that weekend, I discovered that sang for me. Peace.
Yeah, that was a story that obviously sends a lot of different messages. For me, it's about the trait of a good father that I had mentioned a little while ago, that he's not always around, but that doesn't mean you can't always be around. There are ways of doing it, you know. You got to find him. I remember years before that wonderful Father's Day that story was about, I remember sitting in my office at school when I get a call from Kathleen Adams, Kate Adams. She is the director for the Journal of the Center for Journal Therapy in Boulder, Colorado. And she tells me that she's writing a book entitled Mightier Than the Sword, which is a book about fathers. And she learned that I write journals and I've done some workshops and I'm into this long distance parenting thing, and asked me if I would send her some of my journals entries. I told her, well, I don't write them for publication. She said, I understand, but can you send me a few, please? Because I'm writing this book and the chapter on fatherhood is one I think I might want to spotlight with you, if you don't mind. Well, I could be, you know, flattered into anything, I guess. So I send her a few of those entries. It was that evening, and she called me the following morning, and she said, look, I need these entries, and I really want to use them in this chapter entitled Fatherhood, How to Be a Father Long Distance. I said, okay, and she continued and said, look, I can't pay you anything. All I can do is provide the notoriety and to get you to the book signing in Boulder, Colorado. I said, that's fine. So she did, and she identified me in the book, you know, Dr. Hank Rubicek, professor of communication, yada, yada, yada. And she identified some of the entries, or included some of the entries that were really important to me. Entries that I wrote about my son during this journey in being a long-distance father, going to Florida every month for all of those years. She sent me a ticket to go to Borders Bookstore the day of the book signing, and I did. And when I got to the bookstore, I'm drinking a, you know, non-fat latte in the aisles of the books, because I didn't really want to be seen as the person who had the task of reading my entries. I just didn't want to be seen. So I'm in the corridors there, and I'm listening to this guy read me, some of those entries. And I have to tell you, I don't think I cried that hard in my life. I just couldn't stop crying. It's because I couldn't believe how he captured me. It was me sharing these entries. Well, after the book signing, I walked up to him, introduced myself, and he was embarrassed. And he said, "Oh my God, how come you didn't tell me you were here? I would have introduced you. I would have." I said, No. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't want anybody to know that I was here. And all I did was thank him for this magnificent gift that he gave me, this emotional connection, being able to see, being able to kind of get out of my body and float up to the ceiling and see what I was writing and how I was feeling. What a gift. You know, the book is still in print. It's Mightier Than the Sword. It's by Kathleen Adams, A-D-A-M-S. I don't even think it's being printed anymore. You could probably find it on Amazon if you're interested. But what a gift that was in my life. This is Hank Rubicek, and we are remembering Dad on So What's Your Story, only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. You know, there's a lot going on in the world of storytelling right here in Houston. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is really active, and it's a terrific place to tell stories and meet the nicest people around. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next swap is June 28th, so visit our website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to that swap and all of their story swaps. Also, check out the Texas Tejas Storytelling Association, or take your skills to the next level and become a member of the National Storytelling Network. Our friends at the Moth are packing them into Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of every month. So why don't you get in there? It's a great date night because they have the celebrated theme-centered story nights that you will not forget. And please be sure to visit us on the So What's Your Story at facebook.com/SoWhat'sYourStory page, because that way you'll learn about our guests and upcoming shows and find out exactly what we're all about and why So What's Your Story really is a Houston storytelling institution. And if you have any suggestions for guests, why don't you go ahead and text me at Dr. Hank with your ideas at 832-277-1581. Again, that's Dr. Hank at 832-277-1581. You know, a few years ago, a student in my storytelling class told a story that still haunts me. The background is important. He comes in my office and he argues, "Dr. Rubicek, I need to drop this course because I have no story to tell." Well, telling him that everyone has stories really wasn't a great way of motivating him. It just wouldn't have worked. Long story short, I did some probing and prodding, and I asked him permission to tell the story that you're about to hear on various venues, really. I wanted to share this story with everybody. It's a story that he said he really didn't think anybody would be interested in telling, because, again, he didn't imagine himself to be a storyteller. I want to share you the story verbatim, because it's a story that I have a hard time characterizing. It's a little chopped up, a little fragmented. He's not a cultivated storyteller, but still, it's one of the best stories I've ever heard. He begins, "Well, family," it's directed to his family, "another year has passed since my father's death. And on this anniversary of his death, I feel compelled to give tribute to him because I'm really angry. I'm angry at all of you because you expected so much of me years ago when I was just 13 years old. You expected so much that I couldn't provide, and I never had a chance to tell you. But I'm going to tell you now. I was 13, as all of you know. My dad was my best friend. Everything he did for me. I was spoiled by him. He never punished me. It was my mom who always did the punishing. He would pretend to and tell my mom, I yelled at him. I beat him. I did all of that. When in fact, he didn't do any of it. He really had me well grounded. I never had any worries when I was around my father. I was never nervous. I was never scared. He always made me feel like I was worth something. My dad honored me, and I honored him. I remember playing video games with my cousin Gabe when my mom walked into the room and told me that we were going to the hospital now. I never really worried about it because my dad was getting treatment at MD Anderson, and he always came home at around 5:30 that night. It was kind of interesting because he not only came home at 5:30 after his treatment, but he used to come home at 5:30 after work. 5:30 was like a time he always came home, regardless of what he was doing. But she seemed really worried and said, "Gather your stuff, we're going to the hospital." So my cousin Gabriel and I packed a few things and we got to the hospital. It was about 11:30 at night, and I was kind of stumbling around because it was late for me. And my grandmother came running up to me. She looked at me and she said, "Your dad's in a coma, and the doctor says there's nothing they can do except to keep him alive on machines. And the doctor wanted to know what I wanted to do." I said, "What do you mean what I want to do? I want my dad to be alive. Get him off the machines and bring him home." She said, "We can't do that." All I kept thinking at the time was, this is the first time my dad lied to me. He didn't come back. It was way after 5:30. And I wasn't sure that he was coming back tomorrow at 5:30 either. Everybody said that I handled his death well, but I didn't. The doctor came out at about 12 o'clock and said, "Well, your dad isn't going to make up, and it's not going to make it, and you have to be agreeing along with your family, your mother, your older brother, about taking him off of life support, because your dad said in his will that I need my son's approval." I was so mad. I pushed the doctor out of the way and I walked into my dad's hospital room, and I looked at him and I knew that he was in pain. I knew he wasn't coming home, and I yelled at him. I said, "How can you do this, Dad? I know you're coming home, right? I mean, you came home after treatment at 5:30. You came back after work at 5:30. But I knew he wasn't coming home. I didn't want my dad to be in pain. So he died by my word. It was the first time that he wasn't coming back to me. Everybody thought I was so brave. I came back home early that morning, went into my room and cried. I didn't want anybody to see that. But you know, no one knows this, not even you, my family, that for the next year, every day for the next year, I sat on the stairs of our house, the stairs going upstairs, and at 5:30 I waited for my dad to come through the door. And he never did. And I'm really mad at him. You know, I could never get through this story, no matter how many times I tell it. But there's something else that I needed to tell you about this story, which really says more about the power of story. This was a student, I said, who told this story in class, right? And I knew that somebody had to go last that day, and what I did was to purposely call on him going last during that class period. Kind of go with me here. I knew that he might not finish the story before the end of class, and I was banking on the fact that students would be so riveted by this story that they would be sitting there instead of grabbing their books, you know, the kind of gesture, students telling their professor to shut up because it's time to leave now. But they did exactly what I thought they would do. Time was up in class, and they continue to sit there with their jaws open, leaning forward, listening to this young man tell the story, a story that he said he didn't really have and that nobody would really care. There was another student, semesters later. So many of my students told so many wonderful stories. It's not even fair not to share all of them. But there was another student, Stephen Winkler, who told this story about his father. It really illustrated that powerful stories needn't be long. He sums up his father in just a few moments.
Played a huge role in my life. He's the smartest man I know, always ready with a joke. And anytime I needed the support, he was there to give it to me. And it's thanks to him that I am the man I am today. And I thank him so much for being a part of my life. But unfortunately, about a year ago, my brother called me, letting me know that he would no longer be with us. 3 days or 2 days earlier to that call, my father was placed in the ICU, where he was placed in there for a severe case of the flu and some chest pains. My brother and I went to go visit him immediately, and while he was sick, he seemed so full of life. He smiled at us and was happy to see us, and we greeted him as we entered in, and as we asked him how he was doing, he quickly changed the conversation to let us know what we should do in case anything were to happen to him. Things like what we should do with the house, how to take care of my mother, and how I continue my education, which was a very important thing in him. So while all this was hard to hear, I didn't believe any of it. I have been through this before with him and other family members, and we've made full recoveries. So any advice he gave me, I took with a grain of salt. But one thing he said really stuck with me. He said, "I'm very proud of you, and I think you know that." Now normally, anyone is striving to make the people that are their role models proud, and they live for that moment of acceptance, but something sour was about this. It didn't feel, you know, it was more dread than it was hope and happiness, and I just couldn't figure it out, and I didn't have much time to reflect on that as the doctor came to take him away for procedures. So we left for the day. The next day, though, I thought about what he said, and it felt like he was telling me that his job was complete in making the man I am today. But for me, it wasn't. I still had so much to learn from him, so much to do with him, and I relied on the future to give me those experiences. I still couldn't believe anything could happen to the Superman that was my dad. But after that phone call, I had no choice.
Yeah.
The hardest thing in life is seeing the most important person lie there still. It just kills you inside. And I just couldn't take it. But I asked the staff to give me some time and privacy with him, and they closed the curtains to do so. And as I held his still warm hand, I could only think of one thing to say. I'm not done making you proud. And I've said that every day since. I'm not done making you proud. Because he still makes me the man I am today. And for that, my job has only just begun.
Yeah, wow. It's amazing. You know, sometimes students get a bad rap, but their emotional connections, the people that they love, are so poignant and so real. Just like for so many of us. You know, my wife, Peggy, would tell you that she's not a good storyteller, but she's wrong. She recently showed me a photo of her father, in her words, corrupting her with a root beer float. They were standing in the kitchen of their old house, and she's about 4 years old, sipping through a straw with a big smile on her face. Seeing the magic in her eyes, the innocence and childhood joy of a confection, just concocted by her dad. Her father bending down to be on her level, smiling along, knowing that he's sharing this harmless kind of delinquency with his daughter. It was his bending down that struck me most. We often think of strong fathers as standing straight, but strong fathers are able to bend down to look into the eyes of his child. That's strength. That's a dad. You know, here's a daughter's moving story I recently read that I think you'll like. When I was a little girl, I remember that when my dad was repairing something, every time he asked me to hold a hammer, just so we would have time for a conversation with each other, I did. I never saw my dad drinking or taking a night out with the boys. All he did after work was take care of his family. I grew up and left home for college, and since then, my dad has been calling me every Sunday morning, no matter what. And when several years later I bought a house, my dad was painting it by himself for 3 days in the 80-degree summer heat. All he asked was to hold his paintbrush and talk to him, just like holding his hammer when I was a kid. But I was too busy in those days, and I didn't find any time for conversation with my dad. 4 years later, my dad was visiting me. He spent many hours putting together a swing set for my daughter. He asked me to bring him a cup of tea and have a talk with him, but I had to prepare for a trip that weekend, so I didn't have time for long conversations that day. One Sunday morning, we had a telephone talk as usual. I noticed that my dad had forgotten some things that we discussed lately, and I was in a hurry, so our conversations were short. A few hours later that day came a call. My father was in a hospital with an aneurysm. Immediately, I bought a ticket for a flight, and on my way, I was thinking about all the missed occasions to have a talk with my dad. By the time I arrived to the hospital, my father had passed away. Now it was he who did not have time for a conversation with me. I realized how little I knew about my father, his deepest thoughts and dreams. After his death, I learned much more about him, and even more about myself. See, all he ever asked from me was my time. And now, his is all the attention I give to every day. I think about him and how I wish those thoughts were really translated into something else, into moments that we could have for a simple conversation. You know, I can grab a lot of stories about Father's Day, but this one is a perennial favorite from those on So What's Your Story? And it was delivered by our friend Harwood Taylor. Think you're going to like it.
I always remember loving my father's hands in this high, and I would put my chin right where his typewriter was. And he had one of those old stacked key typewriters. Remember the tick, 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 tick. That sound was ever present, and it was like white noise in our childhood. And he was also a draftsman. He did these beautiful drawings with charcoal, and he would use his fingers. They would turn black, pushing the material around to shade or contour a figure drawing. And I saw his fingers in wet clay. There was just a grace about his fingers and his hands that I just always remember being fascinated by. He was also a bipolar. And if you don't know what that is, it's just basically a chemical imbalance that'll make you, you know, maybe very excitable and high sometimes and also very low sometimes. It can be very scary, frankly, for a young family. And it was for me and my sisters. And just to give you a fuller picture, I mean, that sort of feeling of uneasiness, I loved my dad, and he was creative and he was brilliant and could be very entertaining, but just emotionally didn't feel safe. For the last probably 15 plus years of his life, my sisters didn't speak to him. I, on the other hand, decided after lots of therapy and men's work, and men's work is when you try to get closer to your dad and try to heal wounds usually. And it enabled me to commit to have breakfast with him every Sunday. And I remember one Sunday, one of my sisters said, "How can you do that?" And I said, "It's service work." And she laughed and I said, "I'm not kidding. I mean, it really was that hard to have breakfast with him. It was just that I didn't feel safe." So anyway, that was when he was 70. Well, when he was 82, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I didn't know anything about it. It scared me, and I called, got online, looked up everything I could learn about it, and I found the Houston Alzheimer's Association. Great organization, by the way. And they had these classes, and they would put the patients, my dad included, in one classroom, and they'd put me and the other caregivers in the other classroom. And afterward, we'd come and have lunch and talk about things. And, you know, it was the kind of stuff you never want to have to talk about, period, on earth. And yet we got closer. And my heart certainly opened a little bit, knowing that one day he might look at me and, you know, not know who I was. So going to pick him up one Sunday and for our obligatory Sunday breakfast, and it's not obligatory anymore. I want to be with my dad now, because I know that, you know, time might be short. And we're driving along, and I look down, and his 82-year-old hand, beautiful 82-year-old hand, is sitting there on the middle console. And I just had this nice thought: I want to hold my father's hand. And I'm driving, and I came to a red light, and I looked down, and I couldn't do it. And I was so scared. And all these things were going through my head. Like, you know, you did all this therapy, and you did these men's groups, and, you know, what is this? I can't hold my father's hand, my 82-year-old father's hand. What's wrong with me? And then I thought, you know, how many times did my dad hold my hand, little Harwood's hand, you know, as a boy, as a child? You know, maybe my little hand in his hand, maybe every day, you know, thousands of times. What, you know, what's wrong with me? Well, luckily, or saved by the green light, you know, I started driving again, turning this over in my head, and I come to the next red light. I look down, and I see his hand again, and I just say, "I want to hold my father's hand." I can't do it. You know, I thought, is he going to use that sharp wit? Would he hit me? Because he had hit me. So I remembered I was here in Houston, and I turned onto Heights Boulevard, and there was a stop sign. And there wasn't anybody behind us. There happened to be a woman sitting on a bench. I don't know why we caught eyes. And when I took my hand off the steering wheel, you know, it was just a few inches to touch my father's hand, but it might as well have been my foot leaving 1,000 foot. The scariest thing I did in my life. And when I touched his hand, his other hand came over and covered my hand. And it was like he had to do that. And it felt strangely, you know, familiar, like we had been doing it forever. For the last 2 years of my father's life, whenever we went anywhere in a car, we held hands.
This last story is is delivered by a father who never really considered himself to be much of a storyteller, but boy, I'll tell you, everybody is a natural storyteller, and this gentleman proves it. This was from 2011. It was his love that gave him the courage to tell this story on the air, on our show. It's about Joey, his autistic son.
Since I mentioned a while ago, the first place I went with my wife after we got the news was to my mother's house, and she's a woman of great loyalty, not only to the Houston Rockets and the Texas Aggies, you know, but to her faith and also to her grandson. She asked me early on, pals, she used to call me, what can I do to help you? And I said, well, Mother, just a relationship, you know, an autistic child requires constant attention. You know, it's a 24/7 type thing. I said, just a break. So every week she took him out and filled his life with lunches and going to the museums and so forth. And they had a wonderful time together. When Joey was 21, we found a place for him to live. All his brothers and sisters had gone off to college, so he went to what we call ranch college. And he went up there to live with other citizens much like himself. And he and his grandmother wrote each other faithfully every week for those years that he was there. Well, a year and a half ago, my mother died. They lost that relationship in his life. The last thing she said to me was, take care of my precious Joey. And that's what I'm trying to do. So another expression of her love and her faith, she was a good Catholic. And at some point, when he was 25, she kind of had that sheepish look. I knew she wanted to ask me something. She says, can I baptize Joey in the Catholic Church? And I thought, well, why not? So, you know, normally when you join a faith, in birth or, say, young, when you're baptized as a baby, you get a chance to choose. There's a little theological examination. So I'm not a great theological person myself. I had left the Catholic Church. I remember my mother saying when I voted Republican, it was the only disappointment she ever had compared to me leaving the Catholic Church. But so that night, I'm talking with Joey, and I decided to prepare him for this tradition. I ask him, Joey, who is God? Don't know, he answers. Now, my Joey is a man of few words, but clear answers. I said, well, do you know where he lives? Joey looks at me. Don't know. Well, he never wastes his word. I couldn't help but repress a little smile. And, you know, Joey's words often amused me. But after this humorous phase passed, it occurred to me that my very own answers to those questions are, I don't know, I'm not so sure. So we go to the church the next day, and we're up there, we're presenting him to the church, Joey's center of attention, and he loves that. And so I have a chance to say a few words to the community. I say, we're presenting Joey to you today without the baggage of deep intellectual reasoning about his faith, but that I think he can teach you something about service and friendship that are something that will pass any educated person's test of religious love and faith. You know, he loves the candles and the bells and giving the peace sign at the Mass because he goes with my mother. You know, Joey doesn't lie. He wouldn't hurt a fly. One time we were walking down a path, he saw an ant. He held up, I mean, his regard for life and so forth is deep and expressed. I call him the little Buddha because he's always in the present moment. So, and he's not discontent. He has a simple life, and he likes to be of service. So he's happiest when he's helping. So, you know, his tastes are pretty simple. He likes pretty girls, macaroni and cheese, and he likes Cokes.
Sounds absolutely normal to me.
Yep, and he's trusting and transparent. But I think that he may comprehend things that you and I don't all understand so clearly. You know, he's lived a life in a state of innocence, and perhaps in matters of faith and trust, it is he who can teach us rather than we can teach him.
Yeah,
you know, I have to tell you, 11 years later, Joey is doing magnificently. What I try to do, and the team on our show tries to do this all the time, whenever we have a show where a parent will talk about a child, We really try to follow up years later because it's fascinating to learn about the development. And Joey, this young autistic child at the time, is doing great. I mean, a Buddha, right? A Buddha. Living for the moment. This gentleman, his father, is the one who told me many years ago the story about a young Buddha monk who is a Buddhist monk who's walking through the forest trying to get to the train station. He takes a shortcut, and he does so by coming near a cliff. And my God, he realizes he's near a cliff. He hears a roar of a tiger, coming right at him. And this young Buddhist monk says, oh my God, he backs up and he falls down this cliff. He grabs onto a branch just by the hair of his chinny chin chin, so to speak, onto this branch. And below him is a tiger coming up toward him, roaring. So this Buddhist monk realizes he is between two man-eating tigers, right? Now on this little branch, he sees a little mouse coming out, gnawing at the branch. He realizes this branch, his lifeline, is about to be destroyed. And out comes a little mouse, another little mouse, and they're gnawing at it. This Buddhist monk grabs a strawberry off of this branch, takes a bite out of the strawberry, with one tiger coming at him from below, one coming from above, ready to eat him, just rip him to shreds. He takes a bite out of a strawberry, and he says, isn't life sweet? Living for the moment, my God, right? Listen, you know, this Father's Day, why not swap stories with your dad, about him, with your friend, or with him? It'll be a lasting gift for both of you. Dad, your guiding hand on my shoulder will be here forever. I love holding your hand, but I know that when you don't hold my hand, realize you always have my back. Be good to your dad and be good to each other. Don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower R&B Gold is up next with a cool mix of soul. Make Houston's community station KPFT 90.1 a part of every day. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? We want you to keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. On behalf of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't necessarily end happily, it doesn't mean that you can't live happily ever after. Peace.
This is KPFT. Make the connection between your favorite programs on KPFT and your power to keep them on the air. As a nonprofit organization, we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We count on listeners like you for donations, programming, and much of our staffing. That's how KPFT and Pacifica Radio work. Without listener support, 90.1 would be radio silence. Your contribution keeps the lights on, powers our transmitters, and covers our bandwidth. Becoming a member is quick, easy, tax-deductible, and secure. Just call or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go online to kpft.org. Become a member today and join the special group of heroes who keep KPFT on the air and free for everyone. You have the power. Connect to 526-5738 or go to kpft.org today.
The Nia Cultural Center presents the Emancipation Celebration Juneteenth Gospel Explosion featuring Bishop Marvin Sapp, Keela Richardson, and Bishop Neil Roberson, Anthony Hall, live Galveston, where it all began. Friday, June 17th at 7 p.m. at the Grand 1894 Opera House. You can support this event.